Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, really excited to share this episode with you, this interview with Lisa Brown, who's one of our provider attorneys in Northern Virginia and has been for almost a couple of years now, and in the process has fielded over 827 leads now over the last couple of years. So she has a ton of experience working with these clients, offers a lot of very flexible options, especially with regard to the payment plans that she offers her clients, to the point where she will take as little as $300 or $200 up to $500 a month, and sometimes only starts with the first month alone that they need to pay to get started. So no upfront retainer. Obviously, she takes the upfront retainer whenever she can, but she works with folks, and she's been doing that forever, and it's worked out really well for her. She shares kind of how that has worked out for her, but this episode covers two main things. Number one, she was originally kind of doing everything herself, and over these past couple of years has brought on some staff, initially part-time, and then now she has, you know, full-time secretary, someone that helps her with documents, and basically has a support system. She's still a solo practitioner in that she's the only attorney in the firm, but has some support staff so she's put into place, and talks about some of the tasks that she's had them take over and basically offload so that she can, either have more time with her family or serve more clients, and really unpacks that whole process. And then secondly, she enrolls about 5 or 6 out of every 10 leads into paying clients. So she converts over 50% of her leads, and 2/3, she said about 3 or 4 out of every, 5 or 6 enroll out of 10, 3 or 4 of those enroll with her right over the phone. And that's very powerful as far as the impact that can have on attorneys being able to be more location independent. She doesn't necessarily have to be in the office if she doesn't have to meet with them. And she unpacks the whole process of how she completes that online, that over-the-phone enrollment with the clients so effectively. And it's a little bit different than the way in which other attorneys and other episodes have do it. She takes a lot of time with the client, 30 minutes to an hour, and she explains all the pieces to making that work. So let's get right into this episode. There's a lot of great tips and ideas here that you can start to implement right away. This interview with Lisa Brown, one of our provider attorneys out of Northern Virginia. All right. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to unpack the relationship we've had for quite some time now. I guess it's got to be well over a year, isn't it? Maybe even coming up on 2 years here.
Yes, that's right. Over a year.
Yeah, and there's been lots of growth and improvements and all different types of things that have come out of the clients we've been sending you for all this time. So I'm really looking forward to unpacking it. So I want to thank you so much for being willing to take the time to share your story and what we've learned here.
You're welcome. I am excited too.
Okay, great. So maybe a good place to start, Lisa, is just give us a little bit of background for those that don't know you, maybe a little bit of background, how you got your start in the practice of law, and then what is the focus area of your practice and the regions that you serve?
Okay. I attended George Washington Law School in D.C., graduated in 2002. I did a clerkship with a judge in Washington, D.C. for a year. And then after that, I actually went to Georgetown and got an LLM in tax law, actually, and worked for about 6 years doing employee benefits law in D.C., and then started my own practice in Northern Virginia around 2009. I had a family at that point. Before that, I actually didn't go straight to law school after undergrad. I did medical research for quite some time and started my family while I was doing that, and then went to law school. So my own practice has been mainly centered on criminal and family law. And I guess I started my practice because of my family. I wanted to have more flexibility, even though I certainly learned that I would be working as much, but I do have some flexibility. I can work from home when I'm not in court and I'm not meeting with clients. So that works. It works well for me.
Mm. being that you have a family and you're managing that, which is also its own full-time job at times, what systems or processes have you put into place to be able to be effective at working at home? Do you work on the cloud? Do you have staff at, you know, how do you manage that balance? How do you find that balance between, yeah, and I know it's hard to say. I mean, you're always trying to, it's a little bit of chaotic at times, I'm sure, no matter what, but what's worked well for you?
Well, I do have an office and I have staff at the office. So we work together, email and text and by phone. And I, you know, always meet my clients, obviously, at the office. I talk to my clients on the phone a lot. Sometimes I meet them at the courthouse. I think the main thing, though, is that, you know, I do put my family first. So if there's something that I really need to do, I either try to find a way to have somebody else do it, maybe one of the older siblings, or, you know, I change my meetings around. You know, that's the benefit, I think, of having your own practice, that you can do that. You can make your appointments. Obviously, you can't change your trial date and times and things like that when you're in court. But other than that, I can try to arrange things around, you know, what I need to do for my family. And, you know, that has changed, obviously, over the years. So I've got two adult children who are both in college, and they're actually in another city. So I've obviously got less to do for them other than pay for college. And I've got one at home now, less responsibilities on that front.
Right. And I've heard that they've helped out from time to time over the years and in running the practice, doing some books and keeping things running along.
That's right. Yeah. Both of my sons are finance majors. So one of my oldest one has at times helped with billing. And billing's always a big thing when you have your own practice and you're trying to do so many things, like, you know, trying to do the legal work and manage employees, you know, but obviously it all comes down to bringing money in, being able to pay people and being able to continue to do it. So that's a big thing. And my oldest son has been able to help with that. My husband actually helps with that too. And right now he does the biggest role with regards to billing and, you know, just staying in touch with clients who are not paying their bills or whatever is going on there.
What would you say are the tasks or responsibilities in a practice, in your practice, that you found to be most suitable for delegating? So for example, if an attorney is getting to the point where maybe they're a solo or a small firm and they're getting to the point where they need to get some additional help in their practice, what are some of the things right off the bat that you've been found really easy to offload such that you know, to free up some more of your time?
Sure. Sometimes, you know, we need to be in touch with courts to confirm what a court date is. So if a client comes in, they know they have a court date, but they don't really know what it's for. I'll have my assistants contact the clerk's office to find out if it's a pretrial, if it's the trial, or, you know, what's going on. Certainly mailing, getting motions out, and writing letters to opposing counsel, sometimes to the clients as well. Motions like, you know, asking for continuances, you know, so simple motions, really. Actually, sometimes I just have one of my assistants draft even a complex motion for me. I just want to have the outline of it. You know, I just want to make sure that the stuff that needs to go in there, like the certificate of service and the party's names and all that, is there. And that just helps me get a start on doing it. So when I, you know, get that, I could just fill in what needs to be filled in.
And are there things that beyond, so we've got, you know, contacting the courts, doing some mailings, writing letters, preparing some simple petitions and so forth. Why don't you just share who is in your staff, and do you have a paralegal as well? Are there higher level tasks that you have someone supporting you in doing as well?
I'll say I have changed my administrative staff a little bit. I started off with a paralegal who had her own business, so she would do work for, you know, multiple law firms, knew what she was doing. She was pretty a bit expensive. And then I've had people who, you know, in college at the time that they were working for me. And so sort of had to be flexible with their schedules. But now I have a full-time, you know, secretary or administrative assistant who's at the office 8 hours a day. And then I have somebody who's not at the office, but she does a lot of the discovery work for us. So she acts like a paralegal, you know, but I've had to train her on how to do the discovery. So I don't have to pay her at the same rate that I would somebody who, you know, already is familiar with those kind of things. So her, and then I have one other person who helps me. She works about 10 hours a week. And then, like I said, my husband works, and then my kids help now and then. My daughter actually helps with fax and making copies and that kind of thing. My secretary does that too.
Yeah, so it seems like for a period of time, you were balancing having some people work for you part-time, working on their schedule. And then there was a point in which you said, look, I just need to hire a full-time person. Because before that, you were working kind of like a solo with some support help here and there to delegate some tasks to. But then, well, you're still a solo attorney unless you... Or do you have another attorney working in your office now, or is it just you still?
It's just me, yeah.
Okay. So you're still running a solo practice, but now you have some, you know, some dedicated support staff, someone that's there full-time. At what point was it for you that you said, you know what, I really just need to get someone full-time? And for someone that maybe doesn't have that staff member yet, at what point would you say... would be the time when you say, you know, it really is time to just get someone in the office full-time doing the work? And were you reluctant to do it at first? Or, and once you did you feel like, you know, why did I do this before? That kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think most attorneys probably do need a person who's consistently in the office. Yeah, it was difficult for me to do it, make that decision, because I was afraid that I would not be able to pay, you know, the assistant, because, you know, sometimes there's money there, sometimes there's not. I pay my full-time person every week, and I just was afraid of that, you know.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, I haven't ever had a time when I couldn't pay her. Even if there's a time when I, you know, I have to change some things around, I've never had a time when I haven't been able to pay any of the employees. So, you know, I think you'll know when things that you need done aren't getting done and you're really working all weekend and that kind of thing. I think it's clear, becomes clear that you need somebody. And I'll just say, for me, most of my practice is family law. You know, once in a while I do some other things, but it's an emotional area of law. And I think, you know, we do need to have a break sometime over, you know, even if it's just one day over the weekend. If you're not getting that, I think it's easy to get too stressed out and not be able to be effective. So
yeah. And when you finally got that full-time person in place, you know, and you've kind of addressed and just overcame that fear of, you know, how am I going to pay this person consistently? There's times that are up, times that are down. And obviously that's, you've been able to do so. Do you look back on it now and are you still have her with you? Otherwise, if you didn't, it probably wouldn't have worked out, but it sounds like she's still with you. She's been with you for some time. Looking back on it, what has it helped you with the most, having that person to support you?
Well, it's given me peace of mind that there, if something comes up, there's an emergency that comes up, like I find out that there's something that wasn't on my calendar and, you know, court calls the office, that somebody knows, you know, how important that is, you know, and is going to reach me no matter what. Whereas, you know, I work in an office where there's some other attorneys too. So there's a receptionist, and that receptionist, she doesn't work for me. She's a general receptionist. So if something happens, she won't necessarily know the significance of it for me. Whereas, you know, my assistant does. She knows that if, you know, something is an emergency. Just today I had a case where there was something. I was in court and I needed something from the office that I didn't have. And she was able to get it to me. So she faxed it to me. I was able to access it over my phone. And, you know, that made a huge difference. Now, instead of being panicked, you know, if I don't have it with me, then I could just forget it because there's nobody to help me out. I know whenever I go that at least I've got somebody who's working full time And if I really need something, maybe I'm in a trial, but I need somebody to contact an opposing counsel or client about something that's just come up, you know, I know she can do that. She can also run to another courthouse for me and file something. And, you know, sometimes we run and somebody will come and they've let the time pass and the deadline is right there. And so that becomes essential, you know, to keeping that client, that we were able to get their, you know, their motion or whatever response filed on time.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly might even be able to help you with backing you up on fielding some of these leads. I was just looking at the report a few minutes ago, and since we've worked together in September, you've received almost about 827 leads. So you've obviously got a lot of, it might be hard to believe, but you always got a lot of experience taking these leads and developing processes in order to field them effectively, get lots of people on the phone. So I'd love to dive in on that. Are you the person generally that calls the leads, or does your secretary call them and schedule them to speak with you? What's the initial first step when you first have a lead hit your box?
Somebody on my staff gets it to their phone. They call right away and set up an appointment for me that same day. They also get some preliminary information about the client and what their issue is, what they're worried about. They're worried about the money, or they're worried about the time, because, you know, they've got something next week or whatever it might be. So then when I talk to them, I can, you know, I mean, I have some information about what's going on. And I usually, even if it's late into the evening, I do try to talk to them that same day. Sometimes the leads have my phone number. So sometimes I talk to them first, just because they call. And so then I may speak to them. And then right after that, I try to get a retainer letter out to them, and somebody does that. So I send the information, you know, to somebody on the staff. You know, this is what rate I gave them. This is how we decided to break up their payments. And then they try to get a letter out to them right away.
Right. And, you know, this has been, we've had some attorneys that do all the calls themselves and respond in real time to their phones. And then there's some other attorneys that have had staff supporting them and doing those calls when they're in court and so forth. And then, you know, attorneys that have had success with one or the other, and sometimes, you know, have not been able to be successful at having staff effectively because they found that their conversion rate went down because, I mean, maybe the staff member was going, you know, getting too in the details of the money or what it would cost and so forth. So can you share what are the specific things typically that you will have your staff member do and how they would address, you know, any concerns around, you know, the cost of the services and so forth? Do they cover that at all, or do they kind of shelf it and say, well, that's something that Ms. Brown can speak with you about? You know, how do you balance out getting someone to call and respond in real time or as close to real time as possible to the lead, which is really important when you can't, but also making sure that, you know, they're not losing any clients in the process, I guess would be the easy way to say it.
Sure. So it's changed, but what I do right now and what I think is working well is that I don't have my staff talk to the client about what we charge. So they usually do say an attorney will talk to you about that issue. They just try to get information about what the client is concerned about. And because when I talk to them, I usually don't tell them the rate until we're, you know, wrapping up the conversation. I change the rate depending on who I'm talking to. So, I keep it pretty close to my standard rate, but I will change it. I'll also offer a monthly payment plan. And I like to do that. Once I've done that, then I don't really like to talk to the clients about finances anymore. So when I talk to the client, I'd like to just talk to them about their case. And so I like to have somebody else remind them that their payment is due, or, you know, that they were supposed to make a monthly payment last month and they didn't. I try not to be involved in that unless we get to a point where we think that the client really isn't going to pay. And then I need to talk to them about the fact that we may need to withdraw from the case.
Right. And for you, has that been really to have someone else addressing the financial components? I mean, maybe you'll give them the quote and the fee. At that point, do you delegate them to then send out the retainer agreement and follow up on that? Or do they sit down with someone else and they work out that payment plan or what it looks like? To what degree do you delegate the discussion of the finances. And then, you know, I'm assuming again that must be helpful for you just to focus on the practice of law and not having to have your relationship change around, okay, well, now that we've dealt with your case, let's talk about the monies, you know, let's talk about where you're at financially.
Yeah. So, you know, usually in that first conversation with them, I tell them what the rate's going to be and what the retainer will be, if it's going to be a monthly payment. And then that goes into the retainer letter. I mean, I send that off to somebody. It goes into the retainer letter, and then they get that link. So I do use Clio and LawPay. And when the retainer letter is sent out, it includes the link so they can make the initial payment, you know, and then obviously, you know, we start once they make an initial payment. So, you know, they don't really have to sit down and talk to anybody about the payment arrangement after we've discussed it the first time. And I try to make sure it's something that they're comfortable with the first time that I talk to them. And, you know, that obviously things could change. So if they're having a monthly payment arrangement, but they can't do it for a couple months, they'll either talk to somebody on my staff or they'll talk to me, depending on who they're comfortable with. Sometimes they've been dealing with, you know, whoever's doing their discovery a lot, and they've been talking to them. And so they'll just tell them, and, you know, it's sort of, it depends who they're comfortable discussing it with.
Right. And I want to ask you, what percentage of the clients that you speak to over the phone enroll with you over the phone and then click a link versus come into the office?
Oh, well, that's a good question, because some people, I would say most of them pay using the link. Some say that they want to, you know, want to have their initial meeting first before they pay. And so when they do that, obviously, I, you know, meet with them in the office. And, you know, sometimes they've already signed the retainer and faxed it back to me. But before they pay, they want to meet me first, which is certainly reasonable. And sometimes they'll bring the retainer letter with them, and they want to wait to decide whether, you know, to sign it and pay at the same time. So, you know, most people just decide that they want to go forward just after the initial call, and they pay using the link.
So roughly out of 10 leads, about how many of them are usually retain you for services, would you say? I know you may not have the exact numbers, but if you were to ballpark it, what do you think?
I think about half. I mean, sometimes I think it's six, maybe, you know, 6 out of 10, but really to be concerned, I think it's about half.
Okay. Wow. That's awesome. And then out of those 5 or 6 that do enroll, roughly how many of those just enroll after that initial phone call or just do it over the phone without you meeting them in person to get started?
I would say, you know, maybe 3 or 4, I don't know. Most people do. So
the lead comes in, your staff kind of sets an appointment, you get on the phone with them initially. When they set that appointment, do they give them the option, do you want to come in the office or do you want to speak with over the phone? Or do they just say, okay, your first step is to speak with Ms. Brown on a phone consultation?
That's what the latter. So they arrange a phone meeting. And, you know, most people don't object to that because the phone consultation is free, you know, and I don't just talk to them for, you know, a few minutes. I actually talk to them anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour. I appreciate that. And I don't try to keep information from them, or I talk to them pretty much the way I would talk to my client. I tell them what I think about their case.
Mm. Yeah. And that's, this is really interesting because you're tending to take a little bit more time with each client on the phone, but it's paying off dividends in the sense that many of these clients, they're enrolling with you over the phone and not having to come in the office and schedule an appointment and you being at the office. So it gives you the flexibility. Right. And sometimes you're making these calls from home or from other places, of course, right?
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
Not necessarily in the office. So if you have a family or you're, you know, raising children or that type of thing, it gives you some more additional flexibility from a location standpoint to not always have to be in the office if you're able to effectively enroll someone over the phone in the way that you do, right?
Right. Yes.
And so, yeah, because we've seen a couple of different styles, one being just spend a little bit of time on the phone, maybe 5-10 minutes, get the details and schedule them in to come in the office, whereas you're taking a lot more time with that client to develop rapport and spend and get into their case and give them some guidance, and then it's getting very specific about what you can do for them. So maybe can you unpack a bit what you focus on that initial call, and maybe we can talk about a little bit the options you provide, but What are those initial things you're going to cover? Obviously, they're going to share a little bit about their case. You're going to ask some questions, and then you'll transition. But maybe you can walk us through what your process is for that initial call, given that you're having so much success with having clients elect to enroll you just from that first attempt.
Sure. So, you know, the initial call, it depends on, you know, whether somebody's never talked to an attorney about their case or not, or they already had an attorney and they want to change for some reason. A lot of times the people are, they're concerned because they've talked to some attorneys about how much of a retainer they have to put down. And so they may be focused on that. You know I don't have $5,000, and I've that's what I've been quoted. But usually people want to talk about their case, you know.
Yeah.
They want to talk about what's happening and why they've decided that they need to go to court because of it. And so I generally talk to them about that. I just tell them, you know, tell me what's going on. I often have questions about it. And I'll just give you an example. I spoke to for about 50 minutes a couple weeks ago. She just had some ideas that weren't, she was young, and she thought that she really should dictate everything regarding her child, and that the father really shouldn't have anything to say about it because he wasn't paying support. And she really went on that, you know, that line about a lot of things, but it really came down to, she thought that he shouldn't have any rights to make any decisions, or he shouldn't have visitation and all of this. So what I really did was just tell her why that wasn't the right, that's not the way the court looks at it. And that, you know, the issue of support is really different from custody and visitation as far as the court is concerned. And that I thought, you know, that it sounded like to me that she had some thoughts that really were not really related to her child. They were related to something else, you know, maybe her relationship with the father or something like that. And then that's what I told her. And, you know, she really, when she called, I think her intention was to get advice and then say she would do it herself, because she actually worked for a law firm in D.C. herself. I'm not sure what her role was. She was a paralegal or something like that, but it was an employment law firm, and her intention was to do it herself. And so after we finished that call, I thought, she said, you know what? She said, I think I'm just going to be pro bono. But a couple of days later, she called back. She emailed and said that she wanted to retain.
Yeah, how do you balance that out, Lisa? Because I think that's probably one of the primary concerns that we hear about attorneys, of not putting too much time on the initial call and giving so much forthright advice and guidance, is the concern that the person's going to take the advice and just represent themselves. How do you find that balance between, you know, just telling people, obviously there's advising about their rights, how the court views things, and then there's, you know, explaining what to do and how to do it. So there's a difference there. There's a distinction between the type of guidance you're providing someone versus, you know, where they stand in their case. But how do you find that balance between being really in depth and developing rapport and getting into the gritty of the situation, and still making sure that the person, and not ending up spending a whole lot of time with someone that is inevitably just going to do it themselves and just take that information and do it? And or do you just know that that's going to be part of it?
I feel like that's going to be part of it. And, you know, I think because I've been working with Unbundled, I have a lot of clients, and I feel like, you know, if I wind up talking to somebody and they, in the end, don't retain, you know, I wish that they would, but I don't think it's the end of the world. So I understand that they're not in court every day or sometimes at all, and they're basic things that it's good for them to know, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't mind telling them. And I think in the end from that, they often feel like, you know, if they can't retain, that they wish that they could. So.
Right. Yeah. You know, and you said something really, I think, really important there. And you said, well, we've worked together for so long, and you've got so many clients. It's almost like you don't have, for you, did it take away? I can only imagine if you're hard up for clients and you really need money because you don't have an influx of clients like we provide, you know, leads every day, you know, every single day, new leads coming in. You can start to rely on that you are coming into the space from a standpoint of abundance and feeling like, you know, that leads are always going to be there. And there's a certain security in that, that informs and kind of dictates the way you can communicate with your clients. So there isn't that attachment to the result of whether they decide to make a decision or not, right?
That's true. Yes, that's a great way of putting it. Yes, that's true.
So that's evolved for you over some time where because you know, and this is one of the things I think about lead generation that a lot of attorneys underestimate when they're looking into participating in this, is that it becomes a very consistent and reliable source of new clients. And that it certainly impacts your, maybe you could just talk about that, how that's impacted your way in which you relate to the initial calls, and this is just almost energetically or dynamically how that's changed, you know, how you relate to the client.
Yeah. Well, I think when I talk to potential clients, I'm able to focus a little more on them than I would have been in the past, where I'll be thinking about how am I going to turn them into, you know, a paying client. And for now, I think what I do in terms of turning them into a paying client, I've done that before, so I've kind of got a good idea of, you know, the best way to talk to them. And you know, I'm not fearful of that, I think, at this point, that I'm going to say something that's going to stop them from being a client. I think that if there's something that's going to stop them, it's going to be because they realize that they can't, even if I was to offer them a payment plan of $300 a month, they still couldn't pay that. You know, so when I talk to them, I feel confident about being able to relate to them, you know, as a potential client, and just somebody who is going through a hard time and just needs some basic direction and information. You know, that's the initial call, I think. But beyond that, it's helped me be able to realize that if I want to expand, then I probably could expand. In fact, that's really the area where I am right now. I would really like to have another attorney working with me. And I do have some attorneys who sometimes I do some things with, like I may work with them on a case and we may split some of the funds that come from the case. But I'll tell you that I did learn that you have to be very careful who you work with. And so I don't really want to rush into that before I find somebody who would be good to work with. But that's where I am now. I'd like to find an attorney to work with. And I'll just tell you, I had a case and where the lead came from unbundled. And I could just tell that this person who had a case coming up within, it was less than 5 days. But I wanted to work with her just based on our conversation. And I had another matter that day. Fortunately, it was in the same courthouse, but I was concerned enough that I thought, you know what, I'd like to have somebody else come in and just to make sure that even though the times of the cases were different, I just thought I wanted to have somebody else come in because she was really kind of nervous and just, you know, just the way she was. So I did. I hired this attorney. I asked her, you know, could you be there just in case my case goes, you know, I'm not able to be there the whole time. Anyway, that didn't work out perfectly. So it wound up in the end being okay because I was able to get finished with my case and I was able to handle the motion. But it turns out that attorney also had another case in that courthouse and she didn't tell me, you know. So she wound up being split herself, which is exactly, you know, what I didn't want. I wanted somebody who could focus on that client.
Yeah, and there's a number of ways to bring on contract lawyers, both in a supportive role, supporting you and representing the client, and then also being someone that you can work together on a case with, or third being, you know, where you can take a client and hand it off to one of your contract lawyers and then just have a simple fee split as they represent that client. There's a couple podcasts, interviews, one with David Gross from Vancouver, Washington. I think it was called Chronicling the Journey from New Solo Practice to Small Firm, How to Hire Contract Lawyers and Make Limited Appearances, I think. That would be a really good episode, I think, for you to hear and for those that are listening to be able to check out as far as if you're making the transition from being a solo or a small firm, you're considering hiring contract lawyers. That's a really good episode. And then also one that was called Scaling Up Your Practice, How to Expand from Solo Practitioner to Small Firm in Under 3 Months. That was with Rhonda and Jay Shree out of Oklahoma City. And they really break down, and one of the things that David Gross talked about is some of the mistakes he made in hiring contract lawyers and what that's taught him about the importance of the process of going through an in-depth hiring process. So that's really should be really helpful if you haven't heard that. And then also Rhonda and Jay Shree talk about the very specifics of what they pay and how they work in their firm and how they're dedicated to their firm. So those might be really good resources for you to explore if you're at that point where you're looking to bring on some other attorneys.
Oh, thanks. Yes, absolutely. That sounds really good.
Yeah, I'll shoot you an email with those links. So one of the things that I've known about you since we started back in 2015 is that you have always been very flexible and willing to work with clients financially in as best ways as you can. From the get-go, you were offering unbundled services, you're offering the payment plans. And I really love to continue along the lines of how to do the enrollment over the phone and how once you've kind of got a good glimpse and understanding of what it is they're looking for help with, you've given them some guidance on what to do, how do you transition to determining specifically the amount of service you're going to provide? Maybe you can share some of the different options you provide and then what the first step would be for the various type of options. We can unpack that. But maybe you can talk just about the different types of options you provide financially to work with folks, whether it be unbundled or full representation payment plans, and then how you communicate that first step.
Yeah. Well, people who, potential clients will tell you what their concerns are, And so if it's a financial concern, they'll focus on that. They'll tell you how they don't think they have the money for an attorney and, what's happened to them in the past with another attorney. So, I try to pay close attention to that. But the different types of representations that I offer are obviously unbundled. So some, last week somebody hired us just to write a change of address letter. And I did try to, ask her, does she really want us to do that in a way? But it became clear to me that she was uncomfortable with doing that for some reason. So that was good. That was an example of just doing something, very specific. Sometimes people want, I just started with a client last Friday, where the dad in a visitation case has a girlfriend who's also an attorney, but she practices in another area. So, and she actually is the attorney of record on the case, but she decided that she wanted to have somebody else, another attorney as well. So she does some things like she drafted a few motions to squash some subpoenas. She did all that. She asked me to review it earlier this week. And I did that, and then I filed it. So, I think in that case, they really want to have an attorney who's going to be there at time for trial. But many of the things I think that she'll do, this attorney will do. So, or it might be they just want me to answer a divorce complaint. They're going to be the ones who, they just want me to draft it or look at something they've done or just do a settlement agreement. So that's, the unbundled piece. But in terms of the payment arrangements, what I start with is thinking that it's going to be a retainer, about $3,000 retainer and hourly rate of $300. But sometimes, I change the rate, down considerably. So, and that's based on my conversation, with the individual. Even if I change the rate, sometimes I think people are uncomfortable. They want to know how much they're going to pay specifically. So in that instance, I may make a monthly payment arrangement where they're paying anywhere from $300 to $500 per month. And, I've even gone down to $200. I'm trying to think. There was earlier, I think I had a payment arrangement that was $150 a month, but I don't usually do that. But I might do it again too. It just depends Otherwise, then it's just the straight, you know, we bill them every month and they pay based on the hourly rate. Of course, the last thing is that some people want to have a flat rate. And, you know, the thing about a flat rate, which is good, is that it means that I know, too, how much it's going to be. And I don't, it just is a less administrative commitment on our part. Some people really want that. And I sometimes do that, too. But I also explain that sometimes, you know, they themselves may not want to do it that way, because we always start trying to settle a case. And if, you know, we settle a case and their flat rate is more than the time spent, then, you know, they still agreed to pay the flat rate.
Right. Okay. And so when you do the retainer with the monthly option, what's a typical, do they typically pay, you know, as much as they can afford as the initial retainer? Do you have a minimum there as far as what you take to start a case, or do they just pay the first month?
That changes too. So sometimes I include a retainer. And then after they pay the retainer, they'll start the monthly payment, you know, amount. And sometimes they'll just start with the monthly. It may be $400 a month. I won't include any retainer. They'll just start that way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there might be a lot of attorneys out there that would never consider starting a case with just the first month payment, you know, whether it be $300 or $500. I mean, contrast that with attorneys that, you know, like a lot of the clients have talked to that say $5,000 required up front to get started. Whereas, you know, for over two, you know, almost 2 years now, just working with us, and I'm sure before we even started working together, you'll say, okay, well, you know, if you can afford to pay an upfront retainer, obviously that's advantageous. You know, money in the door is always better than not. But, you know, you've been, for the most part, and willing to allow folks to just start if that's all they can afford with that first month. And so I wanted, maybe you could talk about that and how that's worked out for you over these last couple of years, because obviously the fear being, you know, if they don't get enough money up front, that they're going to, you know, stop paying, and then they're going to be representing someone that they, you know, isn't paying for their fees. Have you run into that challenge? And just overall, has that worked out for you? How has that worked out for you, being so flexible and willing to work with folks financially?
You know, I think it, for the most part, it's worked out fine. I haven't had to withdraw. I have had to withdraw from some cases, and I do that if I feel like not only is a person not paying, but they really don't have any intention to pay. You know, they're not going to, they're not basically trying to stop for 1 month and then pick it back up. I just have the feeling that they're not going to pay. So in that case, I will withdraw from the case. But for the most part, I think it works out. People can tell we're working on their case, and I think they feel some people don't feel guilty, but for most of the clients that I've had, they would feel guilty if they didn't pay, you know, because we're working with them, not just me calling them, but it's also, you know, other people in the office trying to make sure, just checking on how things are going and, you know, sending them drafts of what we've done and just to confirm that things are, you know, the way they want it to be. So it's worked out fine on my end. I think that the other thing about it, though, in terms of being flexible, is that it does require some having some staff to recognize that there are different arrangements for different people. And so, you know, you do have to make sure that whoever's working on the billing, that they, you know, always have that in mind, that it's going to be, it's different for everybody. You know, we may be just calling about a payment arrangement. We might be calling because we sent the bill and they haven't responded.
Yep. Okay. That's really helpful to get a long view perspective of how that pencils out. So it sounds like it's pretty rare that you have to withdraw. And for the most part, people are willing to pay consistently. And that's what we've heard across the board. I mean, it really seems like, you know, if you're serving clients and you're continually being in contact with them and working with folks, you're going to get a sense for the, you know, one out of maybe 20 or 30 that, like you said, have no intention to pay, but for the most part, they pay consistently, and you can offer that flexibility. It almost seems like, you know, attorneys have to make a leap of faith and trust that clients are going to make it. And then there's going to be the off one here and there. But the part that seems to be that most attorneys forget is that you're able to work with so many more clients. I mean, five or six out of every 10 leads we send you are paying you for your services. If you were charging $5,000, the numbers would be a little different.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then your cash flow is affected as a result. So the final thing I'd like to cover for today, and then we'll wrap up, just for attorneys that you know, maybe up till now haven't been able to be successful at doing or haven't explored doing the enrollment over the phone. And maybe that would be work well for a lot of attorneys that, you know, need to have some time flexibility or location flexibility, whether they're having a family or, you know, need to work from home or want to have that, you know, just generally speaking. You'll be talking to the client. I appreciate you laying out the different options you offer, the unbundled services, the document prep, representing, and then also the payment plans. How do you basically determine, you obviously, I assume you would ask the client, okay, here's, you would lay out the options and then ask them, you know, what they see is most fit. Maybe you can just walk through how you do that and then how you complete the, what the mechanics are of the enrollment, you know, as far as, you know, having them send a fee agreement, or do you do it over the phone? Just so you complete that enrollment process done over the phone.
I'll just start with the last part, last question first. In terms of the enrollment piece, some clients are, most of the clients are comfortable with the retainer letter coming to them by email, and they respond by email. They usually fax back the retainer letter, and they use the LawPay link to make a payment. Sometimes clients prefer to give me the information over the phone, and then I enter it into, you know, to the LawPay website and do it that way. You know, a few aren't comfortable getting the retainer letter by email when they don't want to make a payment online. So they come into the office. They may come just to pick up their retainer letter and sign it and make their payment, you know, or they're coming because they, you know, they want to meet me in person and start talking about their case, you know, before they retain. So, but for the most part, clients are willing to utilize the link, and they get a receipt, and I think they like that. They get it automatically and right away. And once they've done that the first time, then I think they're comfortable making their payments. Once they receive their bill, they're comfortable making their payments that way.
You mentioned a second ago that sometimes you'll take the card and just enter it right into the terminal. So you're taking the card number over the phone. So that's one that obviously would be live. But if you do the link, do you say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and send you a link, you go ahead and take care of that? Or do you send it with them? Do you have access to a computer and do you send it with them while you're on the phone?
I don't, because I'm not usually the one sending the retainer letter.
Sure.
What I do is I usually, as soon as I get off the phone, I text that information, the payment arrangement that we've come up with, to somebody else, and then they send the retainer letter out, and it includes the link, and so that's the way it normally goes in terms of you know, how they receive the retainer. And you know, sometimes people say, well, you know what, my case is coming up right now, I just want to take care of this right now, and you know, that's even better. So I don't have any problem with that. But for the most part, it's that way that somebody else sends a retainer letter out. But the thing is that it goes out right away. You know, within a day, usually the same day, but it might be the next day. Even if it's over the weekend, we try to do it, you know, the same day or the next day.
And have you found that to be of real importance, making sure you get that payment link and the retainer agreement out as quick as possible?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Because if you wait, then they may talk to other attorneys and, you know, so I don't know. I think, and also sometimes I think people, maybe they have they're concerned about something, but it's easy, just everybody being so busy, for them to decide that it's less important than what they thought it was when we talked. So.
Yeah, you got to kind of strike when the iron's hot, and they're in, you know,
exactly.
They're still in a state of mind of like taking action, you know, like, and they're right. In a state of empowerment because you've given them information, they're empowered with knowledge and a clear picture and
exactly. Have
a clear idea financially. So, you know, certainly that's when you want to give them the opportunity to take that first step. That's the best time to do it.
Yep, that's true.
Okay. And then I guess the last thing I'll ask you, Lisa, and then we can wrap up, is just, you know, we've been doing this again for a couple of years and you've fielded, you know, hundreds and hundreds of leads. Is there anything else that you would like to throw in that you've learned over these years and working with all these leads and clients that you've learned or you've adapted in your process from a mistake you made or mistakes you were making that you'd share for someone that maybe just getting started working leads, or even someone that's experienced that you've just found works really well, or something that wasn't working very well that you changed?
Yeah. one thing that I've learned is that the clients, for the most part, they don't have a whole lot of, they don't know about what we do in terms of how many clients, other clients we might have, or, you know, often we're in court or whatever. And they really just want to know that we're focused on their case, that we care about their case, that we haven't forgotten about them. So I think it's important, especially if you have a lot of clients, to have somebody who's making sure that we stay in touch with the clients. And, you know, people are very different. So some people are patient. They actually do have some, you know, concept that their case isn't coming up for 5 months and then we don't have to talk to them as often. But some don't have that, you know, that viewpoint. They believe that, you know, should be talking to them. But, you know, the thing about it is that, you know, once when they're billed, if they're being charged hourly, then, you know, sometimes they will then recognize that, you know, if you want to talk to an attorney for 20 minutes, you know, once every 3 days, then you're billed for that. But the main thing is that I think the clients want to know that we understand their case, care about what's happening, which is easy to do in family law. You know, even if it's immigration or whatever, a lot of times these situations are ones that the attorneys really do care about. And the attorneys just want to know that, I mean, the clients just want to know that that's the case, that we care about their specific situation.
Yeah. And do you have some guidelines as far as, you know, for your staff or for something, things that you do to make sure that you communicate that, whether it be, you know, they get a call once a week or every couple of weeks or an email, or any specific practices that you found worked well to make sure that clients feel like they're being thought of and considered?
I think initially, you know, because we did start using Clio quite a while ago, which I got from another podcast. I got that advice from somebody, one of the attorneys. Because of that, sometimes I don't always see all the clients, there, you know, who they are in front of me. And often I'm not specifically in the office, so I'm not looking at the file. So one of the things that my assistant does is sends me an updated client list. And then we all can look at that client list and we keep up with what's, you know, when's the last contact with them. And then that's reviewed to see who needs to be contacted. Having that list really, I think, you know, really made a big difference for me, just because sometimes the cases, you know, they're over, but they might, you know, I need to see specifically what cases we're working on now, make sure that I don't forget, and make sure that our office doesn't forget about a case, even though it may be 7-8 months from trial date.
Yeah. So maybe, I don't know if you do that. Do you do that once a week or every couple? It sounds like kind of a powwow. I'm like, okay, here's all the cases. Here's everything at. Is that,
right.
Do that once a week?
Yeah.
Or do you usually check in on that list?
It's updated and it's reviewed. The goal is once a week, but it's at least once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Just so you can keep abreast of everything that's going on.
Yep.
All right. Well, Lisa, really want to thank you again for just coming on, taking the time, sharing so openly. I think there's some really compelling tips on kind of do that enrollment process over the phone. A lot of clients, attorneys would stand to have a lot more freedom if they can learn how to do that. And it's certainly a certain style and approach to doing that attorneys can learn to do. And obviously you're a perfect example of being able to be successful with that. Obviously you offer the option for them to come in the office, but you've done really well for quite a long time of just, you know, taking the time on the phone, and then people feel comfortable when you do take the time and address their concerns. And obviously that you offer such flexible payment options, it's pretty hard for them to say no.
That's the goal. And Dave, let me tell you, I really appreciate you and you know, what the Unbundled has done for me and for my practice. And really, I think it's clear that you want to make sure the attorneys are getting everything that they can, having these leads come our way. And the information that I've gotten from other podcasts has really, you know, made the world of difference. So I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. That's certainly the goal is, you know, how can we serve as many clients as possible? Certainly that's going to benefit everyone financially, but you know, it comes at the root of, you know, how can we serve, you know, working families all throughout the United States of America and pretty soon Canada. So in the most affordable, effective manner. So this has been a real pleasure to be involved in the project and to create this platform and to continue to support you with these ideas in any way we can. And now we have lots of ideas from you that attorneys can learn from as well. So thank you. Thank you again for that too.
Wonderful.
All right. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. For everyone else that's listening, of course, thanks so much for taking part and in this community and listening and taking good notes and sharing it with the other attorneys that can benefit from this show. I mean, it's been growing really fast. We've had, you know, record month last month as far as downloads and listens and lots of great feedback from the shows as well. So thanks again for participating, and we'll see you all on the next episode. For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.